And this is time to get started, so if we could start with a word of prayer first. Dear Heavenly Father, you are our Creator and our Lord, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here at the HCF conference, where we're learning so many things. Help us to take these back to our students and to use them to glorify you and to further your kingdom. In Jesus' name. Amen. And before I really get started, is anybody in here for this workshop? With a Trojan horse? Oh, that thing is awesome. It really is awesome. But I'm going to give you a little bit of trivia before I really get started here. That in 1834, that's when the term scientist was coined. Prior to that, they were called natural philosophers. And for those of you science people, I just want you to know that back in the days of the Trojan horse, the natural philosophers were one step ahead of the military strategists. Not just share from one of my favorite cartoons. The Trojan Green Horse wasn't as big a success as the later horse. And I just had a colleague that didn't get that. Greenhouse, no, they get hot, and that didn't work. I could see through it. Okay, I'm glad you all got that. All right, one other thing I probably need to clarify. If we can put that first transparency up. The title of the workshop, Teaching Science with a Christian Worldview, Beyond the Mole, the same colleague asked me, what do you mean by the mole? Why a little furry thing? You're talking about Christian worldview. And I thought, oh, no. I'm talking to science people. They should know. Well, there are furry little things, but by mole, what I'm meaning is that, which is a unit, something similar to a dozen, so it has a meaning. It indicates a certain number of atoms, which is 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd number of atoms, which is Avogadro's number. Some of you might recognize that. So I just wanted to clarify for that, if there was anyone in here that hadn't had some of the chemistry, and I mean that modestly. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad. Introduction, let me talk a little bit about that. I was one of those, I guess, sacred cows that Michael Eatman was talking about. I don't know if any of you went there. He was in one of his talks, those things that are not good, those things in education that we need to get rid of. So I'm in there thinking, oh, I'm one of those heifers. I need to be. Almost 20 years of teaching in the public school, so I come with certain ideas, but I was a Christian teaching, and we had several Christians in our science department. But, of course, we weren't able to focus on that. And so what we are to be doing, if we look up there and say, why must it be intentional what we are doing, that when we are teaching classically, it's different than just your regular teaching. We don't want to just be an alternative to Christian education where we have just the Bible class, but instead we need to incorporate biblical principles in everything that we're teaching. So I'm coming from the public school thinking, oh, how do I do that? What is it supposed to look like? So I've spent the past 6 years trying to figure out what that looks like. And every year at the ACCS conferences, I would write down on the evaluation, please have someone speak to dialectic and rhetoric level teaching of science. I have no idea what it looks like. And so I'm here to say, be careful what you ask for, because I'm the one up here. And I thought, no, I want somebody else doing this. So what I can do, I'm going to speak from my own experiences, what I've done, what I've tried, and hopefully you'll be able to take something home that you can use. Nancy Piercy, see her quote up there. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Nancy Piercy. She's considered kind of the first lady of the intelligent design movement. She doesn't write just for them, but creationist Ken Ham, he'll quote her, as well as ID scientists. And I love this quote. It's out of the book Total Truth. That if Christians do not consciously develop a biblical approach to the subject, then we will unconsciously absorb some other philosophical approach. And I want to emphasize that with science teachers, because we don't always use just Christian sources. We're using some secular sources. So we have to make sure that we're making it very clear to the students what they need to look for to use discernment when using these other resources. David Noble, we went to a Worldview Weekend conference just last year. David Noble was there, Michael Ferris, David Barton, we met several of those guys. And he said that about 88% of Christian students who go off to college within the first 1 or 2 years lose their Christian faith. Now, I don't think that he meant altogether became atheists and, all right, they're off somewhere else. It was varying degrees, but it was a very large number of Christian students, and we need to be concerned about that. So, again, part of our job as educators is to make sure that our students are rooted in biblical principles so that they are not lost, so that they can face the world and they can answer the world. I don't know how many of you in here have been science teachers, let's say 5 years or less. Okay, 10 or less? 15 or less? 20? Okay. All right, I just want to have an idea there. Because if you've taught science before, and especially if you've been in the government schools, we have a tendency to push content. We want to cover that. We want to cover the book. We want to make sure that our students can compete with the other students going off to college. And we end up trying to make little lab technicians out of them, make sure that they can follow the scientific method. And you know what? That is important. But what they're not getting elsewhere, at least purposely, is a philosophy that goes along with the science. They're receiving a lot of Darwinian information. They're not realizing that. So we want to be careful that we're not doing the same thing or overlooking that. All right, biblical integration is foundation to the lesson being taught. When I'm trying to figure out, well, how do I integrate all of this, I came in the middle of the school year. I hadn't been teaching for a couple of years. I was taking off. I was very excited, but I was the fourth science teacher that those students had that year. And I thought, ooh, I got to do this right, and you know what? I think these kids need some labs. Let's do some of that. Well, I checked out what we had. It was a new school. And so we had one beaker with tape on the end of it and one graduated cylinder that leaked. And we put some things in there. And a great set of magnets, though, too. And I needed to provide them with something. So I was able to go back to the people that I worked with in the government school and my old department head and said, can I borrow some equipment? And they were very glad to let me borrow that. So I just want to say to you that you may have friends from church that are in the government schools, and I think they would probably be very happy to lend that. There was a Jewish school down the road, too, and so I called them and asked if they wouldn't mind sharing their microscopes with the Gentiles down the road. And they were very, very pleased to lend that to us, too. But we've since then, in the years, we've grown, and we've been able to get the money and purchase the equipment that we need. So I just want you to know that you don't need a full-blown lab to get labs done, and I'll cover that in a little bit later, too. But when I was going through the science book, starting here, we did just a little bit of reading, and we got to the end of a paragraph, and there was a scripture, and I'm looking at that, and one of the kids read that, and I thought, oh, no, what do I do with that? That has nothing to do with what this is talking about. And so I kept my head down, realizing I'm going to have to look up at some point. And I just kind of looked at him with one of those, I really don't know what to do with this. And they were looking at me, smiling with their heads cocked to the side, like, go ahead, Mrs. Hunt, try to make sense of that, because we've already tried. And I thought, this isn't going to work. And this is insufficient, which is why you see the word up there. I'm not saying that Christian textbooks are insufficient. They're not. I use them. But that's just not enough. We've got to go beyond that. So my husband found a book for me, Where to Find It in the Bible. I don't know if you've seen this book before. I was so excited when he brought that back. I thought, oh, man, this is great. Let me look something up. We are covering the eye. Let me look up eye. And so I found some scripture, Genesis 46:4. So I pulled that out. Of course, I didn't do this just in class. I did read it beforehand. But I was making an attempt to do something different. So 46:4 said, I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes. Okay, kids, we're dissecting the eye today. The Bible says I. God created it. All right. Oh, that was pitiful. I thought, okay, that's not working either. What am I going to do? So just a couple years ago, there was a workshop that came available by Mark Eckel. I don't know if any of you have heard that. He worked with Moody Bible Institute. He's not there anymore. I think he just left within this past month, and he's elsewhere. But he taught teachers how to teach Christianly, and very passionate about teaching biblical integration. So we sat through his workshop, and I thought, this is it. I found the missing link. It is Bible, it is science, and it's biblical principle. I quit trying to just pick out little individual scriptures. Let's do the principles. So I realized that that is what's needed, because see, the students have, and they probably do at your school too, they memorize a lot of scripture. And so they have that. They have a very wide base in that, but that's still kind of superficial for really being able to tie in their subject to the scriptures. And our school, we're from Brain Academy. We're down in Florida, Tampa, Florida. And you may have heard that we had a few hurricanes go through there this last summer. And we found that many of our trees were blown over. Well, oak trees have a very wide root system, but it's very superficial. But our palm trees have very deep roots, deeply rooted. They got just blown all over the place, but they were still standing. And so that's kind of what we want to do with our students. We don't want to keep them at a superficial level. We want to take them deep, so they are grounded. So when they get whacked around in college and out in the world, or wherever, whatever they're doing, whatever they're called to do, that they're able to remain standing. So these are not my own principles. I took these directly from Mark, and I sent him an email, and I told him how much I use his stuff. I've seen him a couple times since then, and he gave me permission to go ahead and put this up. So if you will, Biblical Principles for Integration in Science. Now, I'm not going to read all of those to you, but what I do want to do is show you, you'll see on one of the resource sheets the information of how you can get one of these. I'm not making any money. I don't sell these. But this is one of the books that he wrote, Biblical Integration, and this is page 54?
Yes.
Okay, right out of the book. And I think what's very important is, rather than covering your science and saying, okay, where does that fit in the Bible, we want to start with biblical principles. So I'm just going to give you an example. In astronomy, I would start then with number 3, natural laws. And so we would look up those scriptures and we'd say, if God has revealed himself in his world, then he can be known. Apart from the one through whom all things are held together, knowledge about the universe becomes fragmented. Because of universal inherent corruption from sin, the supernatural revelation of scripture is necessary to interpret the natural revelation of creation. So we use that as our intro and discuss these, that a long time ago when you're studying Aristotle and on through and the changes that have been made in science, not Aristotle, but a little bit later, the scientists went from the perspective of, we know God created, therefore we're going to study his creation, we're going to come to know him better, and we're going to discover what he has laid before us. So we want our students starting from that perspective, and then we'll go into our astronomy unit. So I think it's very important to lay the biblical principle first, then do the subject. It should be in that order. Okay. Another book that Mark Eckel wrote that I found very useful is called The Whole Truth. Let's see, I don't have that sheet. The one that has the resources, you'll find Mark Eckel's website. Yes, that's number 3, biblicalintegration.org. So the 3 that I have used of his, Biblical Integration, The Pagans Are Coming, and The Whole Truth. And The Pagans Are Coming are very interesting too. That's using, when you're using some secular sources, just some ideas for that. So I would highly recommend that for those of you that are having maybe a little trouble or need a little help with the biblical integration. Okay, we can remove that. Number 2. Okay. All right, why don't I talk to you now just a little bit about suggestions for going beyond the content of the course, so that we're not just studying science, but we've got some other things that are in there that are very important that help us to teach. I like this quote from McGuire, of libraries, but also and notably of laboratories. So we need to be combining both of those. We're reading books, and we're doing labs, and we're discussing science, and that just seems to make a very well-balanced atmosphere in the classroom, and the students enjoy that, and I enjoy that. But some people struggle a little bit with the labs, and I'm going to do a little demonstration here for just a second. Where you see ask for help, I found that right now I'm teaching 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade science. And that's a lot. And some of the subjects I hadn't taught for about 15 years. And so I called my old department heads or some of the teachers I know I've worked with in the past or specialists in certain areas, and I'll ask them questions, and they're very glad to send me an email back. I've sent questions to scientists at the Florida Marine Research Institute. We ended up with a shark specialist. In fact, one of my students did a science fair project, and this particular scientist was a big help for us. Look up in the phone book, you'll find geologists, air quality people, and so don't feel like you're just stuck with the book. Ask out in the community. Contact high schools, colleges, and universities, yes. We have had some guest speakers come out as well, but you've got to kind of be careful with that. The lab demonstrations. I say labs and demos. I try to do 1 to 2 minimum per week of labs. Now, my setup may be different than yours. I have 1.5-hour classes either 3 times a week or 2 times a week, so that gives us a good amount of time to be able to finish labs so that we're not rushing. But sometimes we're doing demonstrations, and one of the best books I've found is Keith Liam. Anybody heard of him? Okay. Fantastic. I think he's probably one of the best science teachers ever. He has put together several books, my favorite one being Invitations to Science Inquiry. There are 411 discrepant events in this book that will help you with getting concepts across in any branch of science that you teach. A discrepant event is one of those that goes counter to intuition, and those are a lot of fun because the students will see that. How'd you do that? Well, the whole point is I want them to figure out, how did I do that? What happened? So I'm gonna attempt to do a little discrepant event. This doesn't take too long. I'll tell you how I do it, though. When the students come walking in, I have my newspaper laying out, and it's from the Want Ad. And so I'm cutting. So they already see me cutting, and they know that kind of sets in their mind that's just all I've done, is just cut these things. So I'll continue to cut, and they sit down, and I'll say, okay, well, I've got a little demonstration for you. I want you to explain something to me. And I'll put that down. I'll pick up one of ours. And I hope this works. Have you ever done that, trying to do a lab in front of your students and everyone? Isn't that embarrassing? But that's what happens. So I take this and I think of nothing, just a regular piece of newspaper. I'm going to fold it in half so that you can see the fold at the top. I hope some of you are praying for me right now. And I take and I cut across. So you know I'm cutting across the fold. And you lift it up. And it's still stuck together. How can you do that? Of course, some of them yell out, magic. Okay, there's not magic. We've got to think about this. If you're taking it, you saw I folded it over, and I took and I cut it. I'll do it again. Let's try that. Unfold. And it's still stuck. Counterintuitive, is it not? Well, what they don't know, finally through some Socratic questioning and such, we'll come up with, there has to be something making it stick together. Because obviously I'm not doing magic. Of course, they want to come up and they want to touch it. That I don't let them do. I want them to talk about it for a while. And then they finally find out, yes, there had to be some sort of sticky substance on here, but it's not sticking to anything else. But that's what's so wonderful about rubber cement. So you take some rubber cement on the strips beforehand, and you nicely wipe that all over it. You want to get it nice and thick, let it just about dry, and then you take some baby powder. I was really worried about taking this on the plane with anthrax. I'm going to be cuffed. I can't come to that conference. So you take the baby powder and you just sprinkle that on there and kind of wipe it off so you can't quite see it. Those of you that are a little closer might be able to see that one side slightly. One's a little more shiny, or at least you can see the baby powder. It's a little lighter. So that works well, and the kids love it. I love it, and it gets them thinking. So I'm telling you that book, there's another one, I think that's on the list of resources. Now, this thing cost me about $52 on Amazon.com. You might be able to find one cheaper. If you do, I don't want to hear about it. But I highly recommend this book forever, even if you've been teaching. I've been teaching 26 years, and I love that book. That's not the only one I use, but that's one of those that if you don't have a lot of lab equipment, but you've got lots of concepts you'd like to teach, that's great. Okay, field trips. That's one of my favorite, and I did have to put in there as many as your colleagues would tolerate. You know, we had 5 hurricane days that we missed, and I had all kinds of great ideas that I wanted to do, but I ended up taking some field trips on Saturdays. We went caving there in Florida, little tiny caves, right? They hit the water table, but we did that. We took our first overnight field trip. This is something I want to mention. If you haven't heard of Joshua Expeditions, is there anyone out there that's heard of that? Okay, they're a fairly new organization. There were 2 guys that graduated from college somewhere down in Texas, and they wanted to start some sort of ministry to work with young people. So they have, over the 10 years, put together various field trips that take you all over the world that are a combination of missions work and education. Well, being that we lived in Florida, I wanted to take the shortest, quickest trip to the Keys. That was the closest one. And we spent 3 days down there in the Keys, and we did some work with the Christian migrant workers down there in Homestead. And then we went down, we did snorkeling in the corals, we did some dissection of squids, we kayaked in the mangroves, got to see sharks and all sorts of lots of fun things. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and a real bonding experience for the students as well. And in the evenings, we would have devotions and prayer, and it was just a wonderful time. So I highly recommend you checking out on the website. Did I put that down there? I hope. Okay, Joshua Expeditions. I believe that's Joshua Expeditions, plural. It's either .org or .com, one of the 2. Now they have, I'll just mention one other trip that I'm hoping to be able to take this coming year. They have one to Costa Rica. That one's about $800, but it includes your flight, your food, your stay, everything. And you get hooked up with the gear. You get to go up into the canopy in the rainforest. You are studying the rainforest. You then study some volcanoes. You get on a sailboat. You get around the coast and do a little bit of study on some of the tobacco farms, as well as doing some missions work. And I think that looks really good. I've understood that that's probably one of the students' favorites. I should also mention the one to the Keys for us, because we weren't flying, only cost about $280. And even though that sounds like a lot, the food is wonderful. You have a guide the entire time who really knows their area. And I just think it's a really good deal, I think, when you start averaging out what it would cost you to do that on your own. Another overnight field trip I want to mention is the Intelligent Design Conference. Now, I'm not pushing intelligent design as, you know, everything's true with that. But over the course of teaching science, my students did a lot of articles and books. And so they're familiar with some of the scientists that are in that particular movement. And one of the neatest things, and we're really blessed, is a Dr. Tom Woodward, one of the leaders in that. He wrote the book Doubts About Darwin. Anyone familiar with that one? Okay, I'm going to hold that book up. He lives 45 minutes away from us. And when I first started working at Berean, Mr. Bray had mentioned this guy, C.S. Lewis, and he really likes this C.S. Lewis. So I thought, ooh, I better learn something about him. So I went to this website and found apologetics.org. And it is the site for the C.S. Lewis Society. Dr. Woodward is the president of that society. And I found that they have all kinds of debates, lectures, conferences, all sorts of things. And I thought, oh, that'd be lots of fun to try that. And one of the first ones then that we went to was that over at USF, there was a philosopher coming. And his name was Alvin Plantinga. And so I went into Mr. Bray, and I said, do you know who this Alvin Plantinga is? And he about fell out of his chair. And I thought, ooh, this must be pretty good then. And he said, yeah, he's one of my favorite philosophers, and was voted the number one philosopher of the 20th century that's still living. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll get these students and let's go. So we headed over to USF, just a few of us, and walked in, and Dr. Plantinga began speaking. And I didn't understand a word he said. And I thought, oh no, this is really bad. And my students were turning and looking at me like, what? And I kind of went, oh, my turn. And I really hated to admit that, but that really showed me as well. I mean, I've got so much to learn. I really need to understand this philosophy. But I'm looking around the room, and there's guys looking at him and nodding, yeah, I really agree with that. And I said, no, there's no way they understand what he just said. This is a fun. So again, I was just motivated and excited, and so I went back to Mr. Bray, and I said, I need to learn some philosophy. What am I going to do? So he gave me some Mortimer Adler and some, just a whole long list, I can tell you. I was just reading voraciously. And so I went back and looked at those notes about 6 years later, and I'm beginning to understand them. It made sense, and so that's really exciting. So I just want to encourage those of you that are just now getting into classical Christian education that it does come. It is kind of slow, but it's there, and the reading's fun, and you're learning right along with our students. Talk about looking for Darwinian subtleties. Here's one of the very important things. When you're reading articles and books and Time magazine, Scientific American, God's World, there's several we read, that I like to go over with them and tell them before we're reading this. I want you to look for Darwinian subtleties and identify those. So one of them I have, let's go ahead and pull that off real quick, and let's put this one up there. We do some dissection, and one of the dissection books I use is just a secular dissection book. And so I put this one up there. I said, hey, notice any Darwinian subtleties there? And they all start laughing, of course, because you see them on all fours and beginning to come up and then fully standing erect. So that was kind of obvious. But it's one of those things where you just want to continually point it out, because this is what they're fed daily all around wherever they go, to the mall, or even seeing it. And they need to recognize that. One of the discussions we had was, I'll tell you a little bit more about Philip Johnson here in just a minute. There was a debate we were watching, and one of the atheist guys, he was trying to talk about some of the things that would work as kind of a missing link between organisms. So we were talking about squirrels and then how the flying squirrels began developing this, you know, extra skin in the axillary area so they could fly. And some of them were talking about how ridiculous that was and all that extra skin just didn't mean that that's going to be developing into a wing, and will it develop into feathers? No, obviously not. The lung system would have to change and all that, and you know, kept talking about that and laughing. One of my students raised his hand and said, oh, my God, you better be careful, because that means everybody's grandma's going to start flying here soon. That was funny, but at my age, I think I'm a little offended. I took note to never wear sleeveless. One of the other events I just want to mention, we went to the Florida Marine Research Institute, I said, and there were different scientists talking about what they do at this institute. One of the ladies was talking about whales, and she said how the whale's blowhole migrated from the front of its head to the top of its head so that it didn't have to come up to breathe. And my students began to laugh. And I thought, nope, that's rude. We don't want to do that. I want you to be able to pick it out, but we don't want to be rude about it. And so later I told them what she could have done then was just say, excuse me, very politely, do you have any skulls that indicate the movement of the holes that shows that transition? I mean, I would love to see them. And I wonder if that scientist, if that young lady had ever seen them herself. But it's what she taught. That's what she's been taught. So that's what she accepted. So these are just a couple of examples. The listening to tapes, CDs, of scientists and philosophers, I love doing that. I've gotten stuff off of C-SPAN. There was one called Satanic Gases. And so they were talking about, of course, the increase of carbon dioxide, and there were a couple of different sides on that being debated. So we watched that, too, and then talked about what are the scientists' assumptions, what are they getting across, and how would we interpret that data differently? And so that's what's fun. Some of the debates that we've watched, the students, you know, in order to do that, I think they get kind of bored. So I like to kind of prep them first on who the scientists are that are doing the debate, whether philosophers or scientists, whomever they may be. And so I had told them a story about Philip Johnson, one of these. I want to give you a little bit of background on him. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of Philip Johnson. He's the one that wrote Darwin on Trial. He's a really brilliant guy. He flunked out of high school as a junior and then was accepted to Harvard right after that. And he's now currently teaching, well, he was, maybe retired, but he was teaching at Berkeley and teaching in law. Well, he was an atheist. But one day his wife came home and said, I want a divorce. I want to go off to California, I want to paint, I want to discover myself, I'm leaving you and the kids. Well, he was devastated, and that very day, his little daughter comes home, and she was going to vacation Bible school with a friend, a neighbor, and she said, Dad, I need somebody to go with me, would you go tonight? We have a program. And he thought, well, yeah, let me go do this, I'll just wait and tell her afterwards. So he went there, and the preacher, as he said, was not of his intellectual ability, but he was passionate about what he was talking about, and he was very impressed and thought, you know, this is worth me checking out maybe what this is all about. So over the next year, he corresponded with the pastor and eventually received Christ, which has been a wonderful thing. He has since then remarried. Well, he decided to take a sabbatical, went over to Europe, and in that time, he was supposed to write a paper to come back to present at Berkeley. Well, 3 months into being over there, he still hadn't made up his decision, and he thought, I've got to find something to do. So in one of his walks in the little towns, he ran across a science bookstore. And in the window, there was a book by Richard Dawkins, The Blind Watchmaker, atheist, and then Michael Denton, Evolution of Theory. I'll just wait and tell her afterwards. So he went there, and the preacher, as he said, was not of his intellectual ability, but he was passionate about what he was talking about, and he was very impressed and thought, you know, this is worth me checking out maybe what this is all about. So over the next year, he corresponded with the pastor and eventually received Christ, which has been a wonderful thing. He has since then remarried. Well, he decided to take a sabbatical, went over to Europe, and in that time, he was supposed to write a paper to come back to present at Berkeley. Well, 3 months into being over there, he still hadn't made up his decision, and he thought, I've got to find something to do. So in one of his walks in the little towns, he ran across a science bookstore. And in the window, there was a book by Richard Dawkins, The Blind Watchmaker, atheist, and then Michael Denton, Evolution of Theory in Crisis, and he's an agnostic. And being a lawyer type, he thought, you know what? We have two different biologists pointing out two different conclusions with the same data that we all have. That would really be interesting. He said, I think I'd like to read that. So he took it back to wherever he was staying and was reading back and forth. Didn't read one and the other, but both together to try to compare the arguments. And he told his wife, you know I'm not a scientist, but I'd really like to analyze the arguments put out by these biologists and see what we come up with. And he said, maybe I could do that for my paper. And she said, well, that's a good idea, but you are no scientist. And he said, well, that's okay. You know, there's scientists here. So he contacted those in Cambridge and at Oxford and would send him some of his writings to check over his science and make sure that he had that correct. Well, when he did, he ended up going back to the States. He wanted to present it to his Berkeley colleagues. So they had a little colloquium and presenting his paper, and he saw that the science professors there were fuming. They were sitting in the front row just fidgeting and making all sorts of disgusting faces, which really intrigued him. He thought, you know what? I like that. That starts some controversy here, and that's really what I want to do. I think we'd like to start some crisis here. So he decided to go ahead and let's make this a book. So the book came out, and several of the secular science journals said in their book reviews, stay away from this book, it's dangerous. Well, Michael Behe sees that, says, I'm going to have to tell me what I can read. So he picks up the book, reads the book, he reads Denton's Evolution Theory in Crisis, and decides, you know what? I am on this bandwagon. So Behe contacts Michael Denton's book, the guy that wrote Evolution Theory in Crisis, and they're both biologists too, and they said, you know, there's a lot of anomalies that I was asking questions about. Nobody gave me any answers. Let's start asking these questions. So intelligent design movement began that way, and so more scientists came on board. Some were Christians, some were agnostics. Many since then, though, have become Christians, which has been a good thing in that way, but there's still a lot of doubt about that too. But once you give the students some of the background on scientists, they want to read it. They want to hear more. They want to learn more. So I pulled out this debate between a Philip Johnson and a Dr. Provine. He's from Cornell and somewhat of an obnoxious atheist. He was raised in a Christian home, but became atheist and really enjoyed debating Philip Johnson. But what you use that for is a demonstration of some bad debate. Now, Philip Johnson knows how to present. He's a lawyer. He's very good. He started off and made all his case on scientific questioning. And then William Provine got up there and attacked his ethos. He wanted to tear down who Philip Johnson was. So he was just talking about, well, he's a Christian. He's born again. He thinks God created. He had a list of 12 things that had nothing to do with the science questions. So there, you're able to point out to your students, bad the day. We were continuing to watch. We didn't get to watch the whole thing. And it was time for the students to go, and he said, oh, Ms. Hunt, we really want to watch this. Can we come back at lunch? I was thrilled. Absolutely, you can come back at lunch. So we just continued on with that sort of thing, and what you see there, too, when I say lectures and videos and all that, I need to move on, sorry, that you're watching, I want you to go to the page where I wrote down some more of the resources. And at the very bottom, there should be something saying Schlesinger Media. Those have some really excellent science videos that you might be interested in calling them or going online for Schlesinger Media. They'll send you a catalog. But I found those to be the best for physical science, some of the chemistry, and for earth science specifically. But again, go over the subtleties. What are they saying? Is it true? What is their presupposition? How would we look at it? What would we say? And that's a very, very good exercise. The students are kind of used to that now. Incorporating philosophy, I want to... Oh, I'm sorry. We can go back to page 2. Oh, that's great. On incorporating philosophy, again, I know I've already mentioned C.S. Lewis Society, the apologetics organization, but Dr. Woodward has been very good to introduce us to many of the scientists. And down here at the bottom, I just want to... show you those that we have been able to meet with and actually speak with. The students have been able to ask some questions. I think they've voted Michael Behe as being one of their favorite guys. He's pretty easygoing, and they liked his little Gilligan hat that he wears all the time, and he shared a lot of information with their students. I want to mention that those of you that may be over on the West Coast, Dr. Steve Meyer and Dr. Jay Richards, they are out of California with Discovery Institute. Jay Richards was one of the co-authors of the book Privileged Planet. Anybody see that one or watch that that video? That is an excellent, excellent video. Great source on our position in the universe and why our little pale blue dot is so special. Okay, and I would recommend this. I've seen this. I think they have that resource room. Recommend that one. Students were actually asking me if I could order them the DVDs. And so a lot of parents were getting their students those for Christmas. Very, very good. Also, just to let you know, that Jay Richards said he's willing to go speak with any school, but nobody ever asks him. He was just asked to go over to Australia and had just come back from that. And I said, oh, we'd love to have you. So I'm hoping we can find some parents that might help fund that and bring him on down to Florida. Let's move on then to, oh yeah, a little bit more on Dr. Woodward's book, I want to say. Is that it? Up here? Okay. In his book, I want to say too, that this, not just for science, but for rhetoric. Dr. Woodward has his degree in the rhetoric of science, which is a fairly new degree, maybe out for about 20 years. Philosophy of science has been out there, but the rhetoric of science degrees have not. And when I began to read this, just the words he uses, the arguments that he uses, the teaching of, say, just factuality and scientific narrative, there he's talking about three different types of narrative. One is factual, empirical, and he's saying that this level embraces any kind of story or proposed plausible scenario that seeks to align itself carefully with the best available data. Well, we want our students to be able to read these scientific things and determine whether it's fact, whether it's science, or is there a little bit more thrown in there? Well, the second type being semi-imaginative and or using projection themes, that's a mixture of fact and faith, which is a lot of what we see out there, and especially in Darwinian evolution and those scientists there. So we want our students to be able to pick that out. Reading this book, I think, would give them to a wonderful foundation to know what to look for from that perspective. Okay? Where are we here? We have the importance of rhetoric. Where I wrote number 4, missing in our science classes on this overhead, that's just one of the things I'm saying that oftentimes we skip that part. But there are many rhetoric exercises that our students could do. I have my students who are in the 11th grade make a presentation to our school called Brain University. They had gone to the Intelligent Design Conference, and each one had to write up a speech and give a presentation on a particular aspect of the Intelligent Design movement, and it was a great rhetorical exercise for them. We had a lot of parents come out who ended up wanting transcripts of what the students had said, and they'd learned quite a bit too. So that is something that you might want to incorporate, whether it's on Intelligent Design or in any topic. I have a list also on some of the required reading. That's not all of it. We do the great books, but I just wanted to mention these books. That if you were going to do a bottom line, what books really should I read as a science teacher and or share with the students, it would be those right there. Do you have those on the list? If not, I would jot those down. Doubts About Darwin, I talked about Nancy Piercy. Piercy and Thaxton together wrote The Soul of Science. I bought one for my rhetoric students, each one. And we don't tackle the whole book. We cover certain sections that kind of go along with the science that they're studying at that time. My book is totally marked up. This was a brand new book, and my students like to make fun of me about that because I'm always following them out the door going, no, wait a minute, and you need to turn to such and such and check this out. But what it does is it helps tie in some information that many of the guys that are in the great books are in here. And so it gives them a good perspective, historical perspective, from Aristotle to quantum mechanics and what that has done, where we've been as Christians, what we let go of, what we need to take back. So that's an excellent book. Okay, next page. All right, what I want to mention then for your page 3 that you have here are the resources. Do you have that? Yes, okay. Right at the very top, you see Access Research Network. There is one DVD that I want to recommend. Absolutely, it's a must. It's a DVD called The Rhetoric of Darwin, and it's by John Angus Campbell. Now, this guy is not a Christian, but he has spent his entire career, over 20 years, studying the rhetoric of Darwin and how he wrote to persuade people of his idea of random selection. And this guy helps, I think, the students, they really enjoyed understanding how the chapters were put together, what Darwin said, what was his motive, you know, by talking about domestic dogs and the changes in domestic dogs. And he got you seeing those changes, and they start thinking, oh, yeah, that can happen. Even though that was a microevolution, he then switches it to macroevolution, but everybody's bought in on that idea. And so then he's able to finish out his book. And the guy was brilliant, Darwin was, brilliant with his rhetoric. And so this is a wonderful study to go along with your biology course. Answers in Genesis. This is something, too, that you guys familiar with that? I think I've seen a few books out there. That would be Ken Ham, Creationist. He has some great DVDs and lectures out there, too, so I highly recommend that particular website. Mark Eckel, we've talked about, C.S. Lewis Society. Definitely go on there, too, because there are lectures and things that you can download from that free, as well as finding out when speakers are going to be in your area. Institute for Creation Research, this one, too. Oh, they have all kinds of resources there, from field trips you can do to, as you see, articles, lectures, books, people to contact. Pete Liam, we've talked about that one. And James Nichol, he's been here before. He spoke at an ACCS conference. He came out to interview at our school, and it was such a pleasure to meet this man. He wrote the book, Mathematics is God Silent. And that is also a wonderful book, even for science teachers to read. And he is just very gracious about, if you send him a question, emailing you back. The way we got to meet him was through our math teacher, who had sent him some questions, I think, and he was just very kind, and then came out and spent several days with us. And then the Schlesinger Media that I mentioned there. How much time do we have left? Not that many? Okay. Let's go then to the next page, page 4, if you would, on there. I think you all have that, suggestions for each grade level. This is not limited to these things. These are just a few, and you'll notice it's only 7th through 11th because that's all I've taught, so I'm just speaking to what I'm teaching. This coming year, we're going to have our first 12th grade class, our first graduation class. But so far, this is what I do. In the dialectic level, basically focusing on science skills, they're coming out of 6th grade and grammar, without those skills for being able to measure and use different pieces of equipment. So we work on the microscopes, triple beam balances, being able to read the graduated cylinders correctly. It's very important that I think that our students have a good background in just scientific methods and measurement. So actually, if I could back it up a year, in sixth grade, we require them to participate in science fair. But it's a sixth grade science fair. They don't have to participate with our seventh and eighth graders. So we do this more at the dialectic level. And it's just for them to have the experience of putting together science fair projects so they understand the method, what's there, but they're not going into great detail with writing the science research papers and all, because it really is pretty involved, and there's a lot of paperwork that goes along with that. So they, I think to a certain extent, do enjoy that. We do some learning the classifications, basic anatomy, because then that kind of applies to any of the organisms that we study, and as well as ourselves, but I think I focus more on human anatomy. We do study science history, and this is one of the things I want to mention, that I had started off doing something like a history timeline that followed along with what our history teachers were doing in their courses. And I thought that it was really so disconnected when you just say the year, the person, and what they discovered. So it was a lot better to go back and really get some more information and stories on some particular people. To give you an example of what I did there, in my astronomy class, we read the book God and the Astronomers, because these guys happen to be in the same time period that we were studying. And there's some very interesting stories in there on Einstein and the relationship of all the scientists and how they work together, because we don't really think of them as working together. We think of them as being separate, and this is what this guy did and this guy did that. But there was a lot of back and forth conversation, disagreement, and so there were some very interesting stories on Einstein and his interaction when a very young man found out some of the mistakes that he made, and Einstein was pretty upset about that and wrote a letter to one of the science journals and basically said that it was this kid's mistake, and the kid wrote back very nicely. I don't know if you ever hear back from your Einstein, you made a mistake. That just kind of makes you feel good. Yeah. So this too is a very, very good book. Robert Jastrow, God and the Astronomers. Now, you'll notice at the very bottom there I have, in seventh grade, going back to that, Ken Hovind seminar tapes. Have any of you seen these things? He is hysterical. He is a former teacher out of Pensacola who is now traveling around and talking about science. I think he called himself Dino Man. I mean, there's a website with that. There's a lot of stuff that we don't agree with it, but it strikes up a lot of good conversation, and we had a couple students come up with some science fair projects about early atmosphere, and they did very well, but just from some of the things that they heard him say. But he has, there are about seven tapes, and it's taken us about 3 years, because I don't show them all, you know, a whole lot, but we just watch them in bits and pieces, and the students absolutely enjoy those. Then into eighth grade, again, they're doing a science fair project. This is a full-blown science fair project where we have a school fair. And then we go on to the regional fair, and we've actually advanced on to the state fair as well. We had one of our students, Evelyn Leahy, the daughter of one of our teachers here, who made it on to state, and the students do enjoy that. We compete with all the other schools in Hillsborough County, and I think they're the fifth largest school district in the nation. They were back when I was teaching there. That may have changed now. But does anybody here participate in science fairs? Okay. Do you do that through the Christian organization, or do you do that with just? Wonderful. That is really a good experience for the students, because it allows them to defend a project and go through all the steps, recognize what is good, reliable, and valid scientific practice. So there are some things that we do have to. Well, I wouldn't say conform to, but that we do need to do. There is a standard practice or method that anything outside of that is considered unacceptable, or you should reject whatever the conclusions were. I'll give you examples. I was reading something on a standardized test that we had at our school, And one of the studies, I went through that and I thought, holy, wait a minute, that was poorly designed. You can't really accept that conclusion. I wonder if the students can pick that out. So I didn't want them to know what the test was or anything, but I did take them a copy of what the design of the experiment was. I said, read this and tell me what you think. They did the same thing, read through it, and they were able to recognize, oh, wait a minute, they're comparing 23 students to 1,500 students. You can't make that comparison. You need to have an even number to compare for it to be valid. So I was very pleased that they were able to pick that out. And that is one of the things we want them to do, not have to win at the science fair, but to be able to recognize good, valid experimentation. Let's see, I want to talk about articles, World Magazine, Scientific American, newspaper articles, anything that they're finding, anything that's going on there. So we do read some of the old stuff, but we want to keep up with the current. One in particular was on controlling hurricanes. I'm going to drop down to ninth grade there. There was an article about the different ways that our scientists have worked on trying to steer hurricanes in different directions. And we found out from one of the Christian meteorologists in our area, and he said that the meteorologists know about this, but we've never seen it in a textbook, that supposedly in the 1980s there was a hurricane heading towards Texas, and our government did something to it, feeding it somehow, that got it to turn off the path. Ended up killing about 200 people there in Central America area, and that they were just finishing having to pay retribution for that, our government was. And I said, oh, he was making that up. And he said, no, you ask any meteorologist. So I'm just going to say and put that out to you that if you know meteorologists, ask him if he knows about that story. I just found it very interesting. But some of the things they wanted to do was put oil across the ocean so that there was less evaporation. I go, wait a minute, we need to think of the implications here. So then that was actually one of our tests that they had to take was to talk about, should we control them from a Christian worldview? What should we do in this instance? So that really sparked some interesting conversations as well. Attend C.S. Lewis Society luncheons. I want to mention that starting in the ninth grade, they have luncheons during the week, and so I take the ninth graders on. And that's where we've been able to meet some of those scientists and philosophers and apologists. And James Sire was one of the last ones who wrote The Universe Next Door. And that book is over there. And that's a wonderful worldview catalog that he had written for his college students. But he was pleased that other people are using that. And so we're using that at our school as well. I want to mention, too, about the science fair. Our ninth graders judge our sixth grade science fair. They look forward to that because now they've done 3 years of a science project. And then they go back and they get to be the judges. And it kind of helps break the sixth graders in so they're not so nervous with the scientists and whoever else comes in to do the judging. And that's a very good experience, and it's very good to have our students help the younger ones. Our 11th graders, too, have gone down and they've helped in the grammar school, the teachers, do some labs. And I would highly recommend that. You want the rhetoric school kind of working with, or even dialectic school, working with the grammar school, whether they're helping the teachers or the students. So that's something that we do when they occasionally have a study hall. In the rhetoric, in addition to all that they're doing above, I've already mentioned all of these things that you've seen here, so I don't really need to go over those again. But one, I don't know that I spoke about, I do want to mention, the structure of scientific revolution. Did I talk about that one? Okay. Kuhn is very important. He was a physicist who noticed what was going on with science and how we would shift from one paradigm to another and what did it take to make that shift. And so he talks about when you start seeing the anomalies, they begin to build up. You see in the literature what's coming out, some different ideas, and right now we're still in kind of the Darwinian paradigm. But the exciting thing, people are making references to a paradigm shift, which is what's going on with the creationists and with the intelligent design movement. So if this is a good book, it goes along, too, I think, with the great books, helping the students to understand what's happening in the scientific community. The paradigms, though, of course, have been put to all different areas of study, not just in science. So is that on your list of... Well, okay. I really try to give you just some of the bottom line stuff that those, I feel, are really must-haves for science teachers. So looks like you've got a lot of reading over the summer. I hope this has helped you in some way. But what we want to remember is that we teach from a Christian worldview first. God created, therefore we can discover. And it is beyond the mold. There's so much more to science than just empirical data. Even though they say we can know facts, we can have knowledge, but we don't know anything about morals and values. And they're correct on that. But we do, and that's our job. And so I hope this helps you at some point. So thank you very much. We can just finish in prayer. Lord, thank you very much for bringing us out here. I just hope and I pray that some of us today is going to be able to help some of the teachers. I know that I struggled and I still do. And I thank you for all of these opportunities and bless each one here in Jesus' name. Oh, if I may, one more thing. I'm going to put this up here just in case you're interested. That there is another intelligent design, but it's called Uncommon Descent. And it's going to be August 4th through the 6th. It's in Greenville. If you are interested, right here, I would write down PiedmontTravel.com. You can go there to register. It is wonderful because you really do get to meet the scientists, talk with them, ask the questions. And we don't agree with all of it. And our students really enjoyed meeting Hugh Ross and kind of giving him the thumb there. They were really on him about some of his ideas. But they're very gracious. And so I would recommend, if you've never been, meeting the scientists, and that's going to get you on your way. So there you go. Thank you.